got a spring or an itch.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. When I was a kid, I had never heard of peanut allergies. As a matter of fact, throughout my medical school training and even during my years of internship, residency, and first decade of medical practice, I had rarely even heard about cases of children who were allergic to peanuts. But now, more than 3 million Americans have some kind of nut allergy, with cases of peanut allergy in children more than tripling between 1997 and 2008. Have we all gone nuts? Oh my gosh, that was a terrible joke. As a judge used to say on the jury on the Perry Mason show, I am asking you to disregard that last witness's statement, or in this case, my last joke. Although other food allergies have risen in children over the past 10 years, we have to say that the peanut allergy rise is truly alarming.
One study of 5,300 households when over 13,000 individuals in 2008 were compared with the same survey conducted in 1997 and 2002, the increase was really noted. What the study showed was that in 1997, 0.4% of children in the survey were reported to have peanut allergies, while in 2008, just 11 years later, 1.4% had peanut allergies.
And taking into account all nut allergies in 2008, children had a 2.1% prevalence rate, while in 1997, the number was less than a third of that at 0.6%. These telephone studies could have some limitations, such as relying on results from households that had telephones and thus leaning towards households of higher economic status.
And of course, self-reporting can be unreliable. Of the 16 countries with data on food allergies, in general, the highest rate is in Australia, followed by Finland, with the least number being in Thailand. The U.S. is number 6 on the list, with Canada being the number 3.
But the real question is, why are nut allergies so much on the rise? In general, those with food allergies have extra-sensitive immune systems that react to harmless substances called allergens found in certain foods and drinks. When the person eats a peanut or other allergic item, the body produces antibodies to that specific allergen, leading to an immune reaction. Essentially, the body tries to get rid of the allergens.
One suggestion as for the cause called the hygiene hypothesis states we are too clean, squeaky clean, living, and the use of medications to prevent and quickly treat infections leaves the immune system understimulated.
This, shall we say, bored immune system then goes and attacks harmless proteins like those in foods, pollens, and animal dander. But don't go mucking up the system and allowing your kids to eat with dirty hands. There are other theories, including the timing of introduction of the food and how the food is prepared. So, if as yet we can't seem to reverse this trend, can we at least learn how to predict peanut allergies? It is pretty well known that infants with egg or milk allergy are at a higher risk to get nut allergies.
The researchers found that more of the infants had elevated levels of so-called immunoglobulin E, antibody to peanut, than they expected. Some of these infants even showed such high antibody levels that you might say that they were already allergic to peanuts without their parents even knowing it.
So is this a peanut allergy epidemic? The number seems to suggest that it is. The medical term for an allergic reaction is anaphylaxis. It has been known since ancient times. As a matter of fact, an illustration in an Egyptian tomb from around 3000 BC shows a man suffering from an anaphylactic reaction to a bee sting.
In the early 20th century, it was shown that although it was very difficult to create an anaphylactic reaction to a food that was eaten and that was therefore modified and neutralized by powerful stomach acids and the process of digestion, it was very easy to sensitize an animal to a specific protein by injecting the protein.
Once that occurred, a second, smaller dose would then cause a serious, even fatal allergic or anaphylactic reaction. At the same time, it was found that it was possible to produce an anaphylactic reaction to virtually any protein, including those in meat, milk, eggs, peanuts, and even in a disease called diphtheria, by simply injecting it. I'm sure that you've heard the term vaccination. The Spanish word for cow is vaca, so vaccination must have something to do with cows. Well, we'll get to that in just a moment.
In the late 18th and early 19th century, people began moving out of the country and into the city, creating a lot of overcrowding. Along with poor hygiene, this was their ideal breeding ground for animal pathogens and the spread of deadly diseases such as smallpox.
In the late 18th century, it was discovered that allowing the pus from an infected cow to seep in through a scratch on the skin gave some degree of immunity. Here is how the cow and vaccination started. Treating disease by rubbing pus on an open scratch in the skin was, well, let's just say, not the best way to cure diseases. However, it was later in the 19th century that the hypodermic needle was invented and the vaccine could be delivered more hygienically.
Later, extra ingredients were added to the vaccines to extend their shelf life and make them more effective. This included carrier gels from boiled animals as well as something called adjuvants. In other words, ingredients which prime the body so that it is more sensitive to the vaccine.
The peanut is an excellent adjuvant as it is potentially highly allergenic and therefore very good at priming the immune system, although its use must also risk not just priming the immune system, but sensitizing it. But vaccinating was not without its risks. It was recognized from very early on that up to 10% of vaccinations, and that's up to 50% in children, would cause what was known as serum sickness.
This included a little understood set of symptoms that included fever, rash, diarrhea, falling blood pressure, joint pain, and breathing difficulties. This could last for days, for weeks, or even forever, and occasionally proved fatal.
However, so great was the fear of diseases such as smallpox and diphtheria that most people were prepared to take that risk. A study in 1906 showed that the symptoms of serum sickness were almost identical to a hypersensitivity or allergic reaction to food proteins and bee stings. They noted that the adverse reaction appeared 10 to 30 days after the second injection, depending on the person vaccinated, and vaccinations marched on. It was big business.
The incidence of egg allergy from the 1930s onwards within the vaccinated population was never connected with use of egg in the manufacture of vaccines, also introduced in the 1930s.
And then there was the mysterious outbreak of cottonseed allergy in the United States, which started in the 1930s. It peaked in the 1940s and died out in the 1950s.
This was never connected to the use of cottonseed oil as an excipient in the manufacture of vaccines.
Now let's talk antibiotics. Let's talk penicillin. Remember that miracle drug? Penicillin started the age of antibiotics. Before its introduction, there was really no effective treatment for infections such as pneumonia, gonorrhea, or rheumatic fever.
Hospitals were full of people with blood poisoning contracted from a cut or a scratch, and doctors could do little for them but wait and hope.
Antibiotics are compounds generally produced by bacteria and fungi which are capable of killing or at least inhibiting competing microbial species. Even the ancient Egyptians had the practice of applying a poultice of moldy bread to infected wounds. In 1928, Alexander Fleming found that his mold juice was capable of killing a wide range of harmful bacteria such as Streptococcus, Meningococcus, and the diphtheria bacillus. Unfortunately, its effect lasted a short time, and so multiple doses had to be given throughout the day for the penicillin to be effective. Well, it's time for our mid-show break. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky with Carmen Lasky, and this is Hey Doc. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
Continuing with saga of penicillin, in 1945, it was found that mixing penicillin with beeswax and peanut oil is released into the body could be slowed and dose intervals could be lengthened to 24 hours.
But time marches on, and in 1948, two things happened. First, I was born, and also sticky beeswax was replaced with aluminum monostearate suspended in peanut oil to create PAM, a hugely popular drug which has been injected into around 37 million Americans by the year 1957.
Last but not noted was the fact that around 2.5% of the children injected with the original beeswax peanut oil combination developed an allergy to penicillin, and that by 1957, up to the 10% of the U.S. population were allergic to the penicillin injection.
In the 1960s, new vaccines were developed which extended the shelf life even further. One of the most successful was the Merck Adjuvant 65-4, and it's still in use today, which included up to 65% peanut oil.
You may be way ahead of us and been thinking, well, why peanut oil? Why peanut? Peanut oil was not the only oil which could have been or was used in vaccine manufacture, but it did have significant advantages.
First, it was homegrown and therefore it was cheap. It was really popular with the peanut farmers. But don't go blaming ex-President Carter for this. Theoretically, since the oil was used and was refined, it was thought to not carry any risk of allergenicity. But research did not always support the claim that refining removed all protein residues from the oil. Nor was the quality of the oil used very reliable. Even in the early 1980s, the incidence of vaccine damage had grown significantly, and by 1985, no less than 231 lawsuits were pending against vaccine companies. The risk of being sued was starting to outweigh the benefits of profitable manufacture, and pharmaceutical companies were pulling out of vaccine making so fast that the U.S. was facing a serious vaccine shortage.
So, in order to tempt them back into the field, in 1988, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program was introduced, by which prospective litigants first had to prove their case in a federal court before they could sue a pharmaceutical company for damages.
This, therefore, effectively protected the vaccine manufacturers from 95% of vaccine litigation. So peanuts kept being used in vaccinations, and everyone was happy, from the peanut farmers to the manufacturers of the vaccines.
Except, of course, the children who were affected by the rise in peanut allergies.
Problem ended up being that no one seriously contemplated or wanted to consider the possibility that using a substance as potentially allergenic as peanuts in injections, which were not only to become universal over the next 20 years, but were to dramatically increase the number and be administered at an even younger age, could create an epidemic of allergy which could rival the original diseases in their power of harm. Remember, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program that we had just talked about, well, it protected all of those responsible for these side effects. That is, the side effects of their commercial bonanza, the vaccinations, from litigation by those who believed they or their children had been damaged by vaccinations by the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And so the pharmaceutical companies went back into manufacturing vaccines with a will.
Then those same pharmaceutical companies, you know, the ones that profited from the vaccinations, developed the EpiPen in the 1980s, delivering the only known antidote to an anaphylactic attack. This proved to be another commercial goldmine, while managing allergy presented endless opportunities for new drugs and new treatments.
But there was even more to the domino effect here. Not only those who created the problem were profiting in more ways than one, so was another industry reaping its rewards. The food industry began creating foods which would be free of peanuts, other nuts, dairy, wheat, and any of the other food products which were thought to cause allergies. Then the first Bush government introduced a program to raise preschool vaccination levels to 90% by the year 2000. The program was intensified by the Clinton administration and promulgated throughout the Western world by the World Health Organization, commonly known as the WHO.
A whole series of new vaccines, most bound to toxic carrier proteins to ensure that infant systems react appropriately, flooded onto the market.
Not only that, the age at which the children were vaccinated was gradually reduced from 2 years to 2 months. Also, the number of vaccines given to an infant in the first 18 months of life increased from 10 to 29, the first dose being administered only hours after birth. For the convenience of families, thereby ensuring greater compliance and to reduce the pain for the infants, up to 5 vaccines were combined into a single shot, even though no one really knew what unexpected side effects would be created by combining different vaccines. There had been no longitudinal studies looking at possible long-term effects of combination vaccines.
So let's get back again to peanut allergies. In the early 1990s, there was a dramatic rise in the number of peanut allergic infants who had reached school age, catapulting peanut allergy awareness into the headlines as schools struggled to find a way to safely accommodate peanut allergic children within a peanut eating class.
Isn't it funny, or is it just coincidence, that this sudden acceleration of peanut allergy around 1990 coincided with those pediatric vaccination schedule changes, including the role of the novel conjugate HIBB, along with another 4 vaccines into one needle, all, again, without benefit of a single long-term study?
Let us not forget the rest of the world. In fact, the changes have been made simultaneously in the countries that coincidentally had a spike in peanut allergy just in children.
Food allergies now affect between 4 and 8% of children and between 1 and 2% of adults. Luckily, the majority of children outgrow their food allergies, and the foods can safely be reintroduced when they're older. Now, let me give you a list of the 13 foods that are responsible for more than 90% of the food allergies. Cow's milk, eggs, soy, wheat, peanuts, walnuts, hazelnuts, almonds, cashews, pecans, pistachios, fish, and shellfish. All food allergies have the potential to induce anaphylaxis.
But there are some foods that are more likely than others to cause potentially life-threatening reactions. These include peanuts, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish.
And of course, peanut allergy deserves particular attention. It accounts for the majority of severe food-related allergic reactions. It tends to present early in life, does not usually resolve, and in highly sensitized people, trace quantities can induce an allergic reaction. Now for some of the more boring stuff. We'll try to be quick. Although many foods can cause clinical syndromes in susceptible individuals, the allergic reaction provoked by peanuts is strictly an immunoglobulin E or IgE-mediated type 1 hypersensitivity reaction.
The peanut-specific immunoglobulin E antibodies bind to receptors on mast cells and basophils. When peanut allergens penetrate mucosal barriers, cell-bound immunoglobulin E and peanut allergen cross-link, which results in degranulation of preformed allergic mediators and subsequent cell activation.
These cells may then produce a variety of cytokines and chemokines, which recruit other inflammatory cells and contribute to the IgE-mediated late-phase allergic response.
When someone with the peanut allergy ingests peanuts, the first allergic reaction generally develops in most children between 14 and 24 months of age, and the first reaction most commonly occurs at home.
About half of all children with peanut allergy have allergic manifestations in one target organ system. One-third have symptoms in two systems, 10% to 15% in three systems, and 1% in four systems. By systems, we mean cutaneous, respiratory, gastrointestinal, and cardiovascular. The cutaneous symptoms such as itching, skin redness, and angioedema. The respiratory symptoms include wheezing, throat tightness, difficulty breathing, and nasal congestion. Vomiting, diarrhea, and abdominal pain, well, these constitute the most common GI symptoms. And finally, the cardiovascular symptoms include hypotension, abnormal heart rhythms, and even cardiac arrest.
Just one single peanut contains about 200 milligrams of protein, and in most people with the peanut allergy symptoms, develop after substantially less than one peanut is ingested, and highly allergic people can react to trace amounts.
In over two-thirds of children with peanut allergy, symptoms develop at their first known exposure. It may even be necessary to warn breastfeeding women to stay away from peanuts while they are breastfeeding. In a patient with a history of peanut allergy, the diagnosis must be made fairly rapidly. So first, a skin prick test should be performed.
The skin prick test with commercially prepared food extracts is a convenient and inexpensive method of testing for immunoglobulin E bound to dermal mast cells. In fact, a $20 vial of peanut extract is enough for 100 tests.
A drop of glycerinated extract is placed on the forearm and the skin is pricked through the drop. Results are available in just 15 minutes. A positive result is one in which the wheal from the extract is at least 3 millimeters larger than that from the negative control. In general, skin tests have excellent sensitivity and negative predictive value, but poor specificity and positive predictive value. Now, if you listened to last week's show, you'll be familiar with these terms. If not, you can go to www.wbob.com and click on the On Air button and then the WBOB Podcast button. This will bring you to a webpage that has links to our most recent 10 shows. Just click on last week's show to hear it.
The gold standard for diagnosing food allergies is the food challenge.
So how do you manage the treatment of an allergic reaction to peanuts? The mainstay of management is still to educate people with peanut allergy and their families to avoid products containing peanuts, to recognize early signs of allergic reactions, and to administer self-injectable epinephrine when indicated. Completely avoiding foods that contain peanuts is often difficult. We know that, and that's evidenced by the frequency with which accidental ingestion occurs. This weighs heavily on the families.
At home, the use of the EpiPen is recommended. Also, administration of diphenhydramine or Benadryl is usually indicated. The patient should be transported to the emergency facility as soon as possible.
There are some caveats to prevention. First, people need to read all ingredient labels when purchasing prepackaged foods and to ask about the risks of cross-contamination at restaurants and other public eateries. Children should be discouraged from sharing food at school or parties and should be encouraged to wash their hands after meals. School personnel should be made aware that a child has a food allergy and should be provided with photo identification of the child and a list of their known allergies. Children with food allergies should always wear medic alert bracelets.
Therapeutic interventions are actively being pursued to prevent and manage food allergies. Humanized anti-immunoglobulin E, monoclonal antibody therapy, and various modified immunotherapy regimens are under investigation, including cytokine modulation, plasma DNA immunotherapy, bioengineered proteins, and peptide immunotherapy are being considered.
Humanized monoclonal IgE antibodies bind to natural IgE and prevent their binding to the receptors on mast cells and basophils. In a recent study that involved 84 adults with peanut allergy, promising data with the use of humanized monoclonal IgG1 antibody directed against the IgE were reported. A significant increase in the threshold dose of peanut flour required to provoke allergic symptoms was demonstrated.
Traditional immunotherapy has been attempted for peanut desensitization, but an unacceptably high rate of systemic reactions has limited its clinical application.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We've also set up a website for our Medical Marijuana Society at www.medmarsoc.com. That's www.medmarsoc.com. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com. Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.